Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Boys, we're going to talk some Timmy K today. We have not done that on this program since Tim Keller passed a few weeks ago. There was a flurry of activity and the Make It About Me Olympics happened, and we didn't participate in any of that. But we've all enjoyed his work, loved his work over the years, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Boys, I'm doing this under a little bit of adversity. I've got an AC unit out in the house. The temperature outside is roughly like pit of hell level. So if I get any kind of call, text, email from a contractor, I'm going to do it. So if I disappear mid-show, you guys are going to have to just carry it for me. And I know you're capable. I know you're up to the task. So just a little FYI on that. Boys, let's take a break. Let's pay some bills. Not many. We're not paying a lot of bills, to be clear. But we'll take a little break. On the other side of it, we'll talk some Timmy K.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, boys, we're back. I want to start with a just kind of baseline question. When did you become aware of Tim Keller, and how did he drift through your transom? Like, when was it? What was the book or the sermon or the way of becoming acquainted with the work of Tim Keller? Pipe, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the year. I'm actually looking it up right now. I'm trying to figure out when The Reason for God came out. You know, his first, because yeah. It wasn't his first book, but it was his it was the one that kind of blew up, put him on the map in terms of sort of evangelical fame. And I feel like it was early 2000s, I feel like. You know, 2006, yeah. 2007, somewhere around there.
I think it was 2008, actually.
Was it 2008? Okay. Let's see here, 2009. So yeah, you were closer than I was. So yeah, and so I became aware of him with the rise of that book, but with kind of a general disinterest, yeah, because it was an apologetics book, and because it was kind of a scene that I wasn't interested in terms of sort of winning debates about blah blah blah. I also lived, yeah, in Wheaton, which means there weren't any debates about the existence of God. Like, it's, yeah, it's the most Bible-belty place in the North. And yeah, so the New York reality that he was sort of speaking into and like being on the front end of post-Christian hadn't registered for me. Yeah. So that's when I became aware of him. And I wasn't snide towards him. I was just like, oh, he's doing a thing. It kind of felt like missionary work. I was like, oh, you're doing a sure cool thing elsewhere. And it wasn't until that the what was it? Prodigal God and Counterfeit Gods came, yeah, out. And it was Counterfeit Gods was the first one that I encountered of his. And I want to say that was 2011, 2012. Yeah. That really, I began to resonate with him as sort of like a cultural pastor more than, yeah, a cultural apologist.
Yeah. He occupied an interesting space in like the first wave of, you know, Reformedom getting popular. You know, you had kind of the older guys, your dad, Sproul-y, you know, J.I. Packer, some of those guys. And then you had the young guys, like the Kevin DeYoung crowd. Keller, even though he is an older guy, he kind of lived in the middle for me. You know, he wasn't frisky like KDY and those guys. And you know, he wasn't writing to me like hard, tough to read theological work. I don't know. There was a heart to it. And I think he occupied, for me, an interesting space of, oh, you can love this theology. You cannot be squishy about stuff. He wasn't shooting for some sort of beige cultural middle, but there was like pathos to it. And yeah, it really resonated with me. Baby, what about you? What, like, when and how did the Tim Keller thing happen for you?
Yeah. So for me, it was, I remember it was like mid-2000s, and I was at the church I was at, and had a bunch of you know, seminary dudes, future church plant dudes, and I remember one guy in particular that I'd become friends with. He just would not stop talking about this guy named Tim Keller. And I mean I'd never heard the name before, and you know, I mean, even back then, you know, going on 20 years ago, it wasn't as easy just to say, oh, let me go check him out, you know. I mean, it was, yeah, things were still in process with media and all that. And, but I remember just the guy would never shut up about him. It was pre TGC and big conference circuit, so I wasn't seeing him. And then, I remember, I think it was like you, Big T. I remember the first, it wasn't until probably 5, 6, 7 years later when I got Counterfeit Gods.
Yeah.
And, I just remember reading
that.
It's
a great one.
Oh yeah, and I remember, you know, again, as your theology is always developing, I had just never read anything like that.
Yeah.
And the way that he wrote, you know, I'd never read anybody write that way. I had already read Sproul and all those guys. Mm-hmm. And so I was, you know, I was well into, you know, sort of that whole particular, you know, theological corner. And but TK, man, he just, I couldn't get over like the profound things that he was saying in such a simple way. And
yes,
it made me think. It just changed my way of thinking about certain things. And that was it. You know, I wanted to grab everything. Well, yeah, he hadn't written a lot of stuff at that point, but it was just, I was super interested.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, what a unique gifting and what a unique like moment for him to use it in that, there are certain people that are just never going to pick up, I don't know, all 400 pages of a John Piper book or whatever. Like, that's going to feel daunting. But I think the way that Keller's books looked, the way they felt, you know, they didn't weigh 14 pounds. You know, they were small books. They were easy to read. And yet, to your point, baby, like, truly profound. I think the first one I read was Prodigal God. And yeah, just absolutely loved it. You know, absolutely loved it. Absolutely resonated with it. I think I grabbed Counterfeit God shortly thereafter, and was kind of off and running with Timmy K.
What strikes me about what both of you guys said was, you know, you're talking about sort of the rise of, you know, Reformed, because that was sort of like pinnacle, apex, young, restless, Reformed, like takeoff. You know, early 2000s, mid 2000s. It's when all of that stuff was just exploding in terms of church movements and marketplace and books and all this stuff. And like, Tim wasn't part of it at all.
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason I was confused by him, because it took me a long time to realize he was Presbyterian. Like,
Yeah.
Because I, you know, at the time I was working at Crossway Books and I was very much in the Reformed world, and like, Presbyterians wear that stuff like a jersey.
Oh yeah.
And Reformed people, like, it was like, they're like William Wallace's army. They got like blue face paint on screaming, you know, I am Reformed. And he didn't. Like, you read his stuff and you're like, none of this conflicts with Reformedom. He very clearly believes deeply in the sovereignty of God.
Yeah.
And he's not beating me over the head with any of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to make of that, because I'm so used to being beaten over the head that I it's part of the reason I loved him so much, because I resonated more with his sort of C.S. Lewis-esque thought processes, you know, just the way that he laid out arguments so clearly, like, because like you said, Ronnie, just sort of profound things in such a clear, simple way. And I was like, oh, he, he doesn't need to shove reformdom in anybody's face. He can just say these deep, clear things in a way that you can go, oh, wow, I had never thought of it like that.
Well, it was like, it was weird because it was like when you, okay, so when you listen to Sproul, like that guy did not like or teach anything without talking about, you know, the reformers, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's like you've never heard Keller like go there. Like he talked a lot about historical things and thinkers, philosophers, mm-hmm. but he never was harping on, you know, Reformed theology as Reformed theology. It was like,
right.
Yeah, okay, you know, Tulip's great. I buy all into that, but that's just not what I'm going to be talking about, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, no, he did. And Pipe, speak to this. So you were with Crossway as Keller was starting to pop. Another reason I was like kind of drawn to him was that he didn't seem to market. Like, he didn't do any self-promoting that I knew of, and yet his books were really successful. Like, how did that happen? For lack of a more eloquent question, like how did he happen as a successful author? Was it just like he writes great books, word gets out? You know, this is back when pastors were blogging, you know, are they all blogging about mm-hmm. it, telling each other about it? Like, how did the marketing side of Tim Keller work?
Man, I don't know the insides of how they kind of did it as a ministry. I think at that mm-hmm. point their church was, you know, it was really well established, but I don't think they were sort of like a communications, you know, superpower.
Mm-hmm.
I think a ton of it had to do with being in New York. Because almost every other big name Christian author publisher at the time was coming out of kind of a Christian haven.
Yeah.
You know, it was so just prior to this, you know, had been sort of the Purpose Driven Life era. That was Rick Warren. Yeah. That's coming out of Saddleback. Well, that's in Orange County, and Orange County is in a very liberal state, but it is a super conservative place, like sort of mega churches everywhere, that kind of thing. You know, books coming out of Wheaton, books coming out of Colorado Springs, books coming out of Grand Rapids, these like Christian havens.
Bastions.
And mm-hmm. and here comes Tim Keller, who is a successful, faithful preacher of the gospel in a city that is as far advanced as any American city away from sort of Christian roots. And he published with, I think it was with Penguin at the time. And he's probably still with Penguin, but they've been merged and bought by 11 other publishing companies since or something. And so there was just a, like, his books went to Barnes & Noble, not to Family Christian stores, not to Lifeway stores first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an apologetics thing. And I remember the shift where, so he was known as this apologetics guy, you know, like he's writing in the era of like Christopher Hitchens and was it Sam Harris? The new atheist guys.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel Dennett, those guys. So he's writing in response to that. And so this is a cultural phenomenon. And so when he comes out with Prodigal God, Counterfeit Gods, these more sort of pastoral books, there was skepticism about that because it kind of in the Christian world, but those then worked because you were 2 or 3 years into the Gospel Coalition having taken off, because I think that launched 2007 2008, and so those came out 2010 2011 2012. And so now there was a core of this, and Keller was part of the founding of that. He and D.A. Carson are like godfathers of the Gospel Coalition. So he had sort of earned his credentials in this broader reformed world. And so I think a lot of it had to do with that. When he started, it was weird because you're like, this guy's a faithful pastor in a city that none of us understand, and he's putting out books in a way that none of us are doing.
Yeah.
And it's working way better than anything we're doing.
Yeah, dude, he's kind of like the kid that comes in freshman year and goes right to the varsity. And he's like walking past your locker room to the like the big boy locker room. And it's like, yeah, I'm a little better than you guys. Publishing with Penguin, you know, a little bit of a flex. Like, have fun with your, you know, Moody book or your Crossway book or whatever. But that was super cool. Boys, let's take a break. And on the other side, I got another question for you. All right, we're back. Here's my question, baby. Did Timmy K like start New York for Christians? Like, or was the New York thing like already a thing and he was just a part of it, or did he start it?
I mean, dude, that is such a great question. I mean, I wouldn't have any hard data on any of this, yeah. But I don't know that it's any accident that, you know, I mean, just even in terms of church planting, I think, you know, it was one thing to know that, you know, that he was putting out books that people were kind of just gobbling up, you know, Prodigal God, Reason for God, Counterfeit yeah. Gods, and a little bit of a theme with the title there now that I'm saying those titles.
Yeah.
But I think it was when you found out that he was a church planner and that you got a sense of his story coming in there in his mid-40s in 1989, mm-hmm. you know, coming from a small town church to plant in the city. And so as A29 and all these church planning movements were gaining so much steam around that time, it's impossible to think that, I mean, obviously he started, I mean, I don't know that he started it, but he definitely popularized this thought that said, we got to plant in the cities. And yeah. So the big movement towards city planting, and then, you know, he put out Center Church eventually. And so, I mean, I think you would have to say that he, you know, spearheaded that movement, you know, yeah. Because all of these young church planters were so influenced by him, and you know that he basically established a dream. He basically yeah. said, hey, look, you can do this. And then there's just, you know, sort of the romance and yeah. the sexiness that kind of comes in with going to these old cities, mm-hmm. and you know, with you know, again, you know, because it's A29 and some of these other movements, you know, they added the bravado to it, but yeah. But you know, Keller had just kind of gone in, not purposefully starting a movement, but ending up starting a movement, you know, with this.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah I think there's no way that he hasn't influenced just a whole generation of millennials and Gen X's to like go to the city, and mm-hmm. he made it appealing for sure. I mean, I think when you think of, I mean, I know I'm thinking of a few guys right now that went to New York City, and it had to have been influenced by Keller, because there's a romance to it for sure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And one thing I like about him is that he was the least insufferable guy about it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, of all the guys that have gone to New York to do that, he was like the most pleasant and humble one, it seems like.
He wrote about, you know, he started writing about urban church planting after having done it for like 17 years. Because Redeemer yeah. was planted, I think, in like 89. And yeah. Yeah. and he didn't want to plant in New York. Like, yeah. it was one of those, like, God had to crowbar him there away from a church in kind of small town Virginia where he was yeah. thriving. And yeah. and it became very clear that God wanted him there. And so he's like the guy who has been married for 40 years before he writes a marriage book, instead of the guy yes. who's been married for 7 years before he writes the marriage book.
Dude, that's such a great point in our business. And it's a great argument for, like, yeah, maybe do something for more than 5 minutes before you declare yourself, you know, the authority on it. And gosh, that's appealing. It's easy to like that, you know?
Well, and he also, I mean, he very intentionally, like when he put out Center Church, for example, which again was like in the 20-teens, maybe 2014, something like that. He basically laid out a strategy that said, if you reach the cities, you reach the world, because they're mm-hmm. cultural hubs, which... you know, probably statistically, that's largely true. I mean, I remember going to so yeah. many conferences when I worked in publishing where that was the thing, where it's like, by the year 2025, 80% of the world's population is going to live in cities, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Same statistics repeated everywhere. And Keller was part of that. What he did, though, was create a version. I mean, I don't think he did this on purpose. A version of church planting that is like, call it like yuppie church planting.
Yeah.
Because the people who have followed him into the city are like, they're going to like Greenpoint, Brooklyn. They're not going to like the Bronx. Right. You know? And right. But the thing is, when Keller moved into New York in the 80s, New York sucked. Like in the 70s and 80s, it was an awful city. And that's the true. City changed over time. So by the time his ministry was really well known, it had a glossy sheen on it. But that's because he had like served through the worst years of New York. Well, maybe not the worst, but some very low years of New York. And now it's, you know, it has a different shine to it.
Oh, 100%. I got a quick digression just by way of a question for both of you. Do you guys like New York? Like, do you like going there? What's your relationship with it? I hate it for the first 24 hours and then I love it. But it takes me like 24 hours to get like my New York legs underneath me. And then I start to really enjoy it. What's both of your relationships with that city? Baby, you can go first.
Oh man, I spent more time in upstate New York, to be honest, than New York City. Mm-hmm. I really love upstate.
They're so similar. They're exactly the same.
They're exactly the same, but I actually love some of the Rust Belty upstate New York, Buffalo-y kind of, I like some of those towns. There's something about them that I've enjoyed over the years. I've spent some time there. I've not spent a lot of just like hardcore time in New York City, but you know what? It's a little chaotic for me. It's a little busy. It's a little crowded. I can say the times that I've spent in the city, it's not been the most enjoyable thing for me. And it's probably because I'm not that curious. I'm not that fascinated by it. And again, that's I don't mean that in a snobby way. It's just for whatever reason, it doesn't pique my interest the way it does for a lot of people.
Sure.
And I wouldn't be particularly like drawn to going to visit there for, you know, an extended period of time. I don't know. Too much chaos, too much noise. I'm sounding like the converted small town dude that I am now, but that's, yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. I totally get it. Pipe, what about you?
I love it. I love New York so much. And not from like a, you know, I watched Sex in the City, so now I want to go like, do that, you know, or like Friends or whatever. Just I love the energy of cities, and that's true. Like I've been to like Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Kampala, Uganda, and you know, all various cities around the world, and I love them all because cities are just I feel like I kind of roll in there, and there's an energy, there's a fun, there's, you know, Ronnie said he's, you know, kind of not that curious about it. I feel like I'm just like, oh, I want to figure out everything about this city, but I want to figure it out from the perspective of like, how did the city come to be? Like I've read a decent amount on like the history of New York and how was it formed? How did it go from being New Amsterdam to New York and all this kind of stuff? So I'm kind of a nerd/junkie and also love just the food, the people, the energy. Like I like Times Square as much as I like Battery Park, as much as I like Brooklyn, as much as I like Yankee Stadium. So, you know, I love it.
What's your favorite American city, Pipe?
Chicago. I mean,
Mine too.
I've been to, I think, most of the major American cities. Chicago holds it down as the absolute best, especially if you go between like late May and end of October. You know, it's not as awesome in the winter, but I love Chicago.
Dude, speaking of Chicago, have you watched the show called The Bear on Hulu or FX?
I have not.
Dude,
I haven't seen it yet. I was just in Chicago a couple days ago. My daughter was telling me about it, though, and they were like raving about it.
Dude, The Bear is phenomenal. It is the single most Chicago thing about Chicago that I've ever watched.
It just
nails it, dude. It nails it. It's kind of romantic about Chicago without being saccharine. It's romantic about food. The character work is exquisite. I love it. And as a Chicago guy, I think it'll resonate with you. So you should dial it up and then let me know what you think about it.
Yes, absolutely. This looks amazing. I just Googled it.
Yeah, his brother dies and he inherits like a Italian beef Chicago, you know, storefront and has to run it. And the kid is like, he's like a Michelin rated chef. Like he's one of the best like young chefs in the world. And he quits that to come like, you know, sling sandwiches in this beef place. It's amazing. Boys, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll hit one more Keller thing. All right, boys, back off that third ad break. Last question. If you could ask Keller one thing, what would it be? So as you think about his career as a pastor, as an author, just as a kind of man about church and reformdom, like, what would you ask Keller if you had one shot at it? Baby, let's start with you.
Yeah, I just read his bio, or not, it wasn't really, it was a sort of bio that Colin Hanson wrote, but, which I thought was good, but, I'm kind of wanting an actual bio. I would love for somebody to.
Now,
to
what made it not an actual bio? I thought that's
well,
what it
was. Well, it was about the things that kind of formed him spiritually through the years. Okay. So Colin took like a different approach to it. I mean, it definitely had bio stuff in it for sure.
Sure, sure.
But it wasn't a hard bio. But no, I think I would ask him if I could sit down and have a cup of coffee with Keller. Coffee with Keller.
Yeah.
I think I would just say, hey, tell me two things that were super hard for you, you know, that nobody knew about, whether it's related to pastoring, marriage, you know, being a dad, and things that people would have never known about you because they were just private, or you just, you know, it just never came up for you. You didn't write about it.
Yeah.
And tell me how you worked through that, you know, between you and the Lord. And because I have a feeling like it would be something that has been hard for me, and I would love to hear his take on it. What was hard for you, I think, is what I'd ask. Yeah.
Yeah. He was kind of fascinatingly private about certain things, you know, like he never platformed his family, for example. Like, I don't know what his wife looks like. I don't know what his kids look like. Like there was never any sense of, I think, coming into social media so late in the game helped him in that regard.
Yeah, I think so.
But as a result, there's a lot we don't know about, which is fine. Like, that's how it used to be for everybody. Those are good. Pipe, what would you ask him?
Man, that's a hard question, because I feel like the public stuff he was really open about, you know, how, you know, like one of the first questions that came to mind was, you know, how do you maintain kind of cultural relevance in ministry without going culturally crazy? And then I was like, wait a minute, he makes that very obvious. I don't actually need to ask him that. You just follow the thread of what he did for like 40 straight years. And you're like, oh, that's how. I think it would have to be, it would have to be something more about private character. So not dissimilar from what Ronnie was asking, but more just, I admire more and more people who are faithful and joyful for decades in ministry. Because it's really hard to be both of those. There's a lot of faithful people, and they're not any fun to be around. Like at the end, Keller seemed to have as much or more kind of personality, comfortable in his own skin. While he wasn't public about his family, he was not private about, you know, admiring and honoring them. And loving his wife, especially. He never dragged his kids into the spotlight, but like one of his sons is pastors one of the Redeemer campuses. So clearly that doesn't happen without some good relationships. I think it would just have to be sort of, what were the things that you did on a habitual basis to maintain joy in the Lord, and, you know, and then obviously the tendrils of that in family and ministry, because he finished so well, like as well as anybody I'm aware of, at least in public ministry. And it's so admirable.
Oh man. Yeah. Well said. And the finishing well piece is probably, you know, what I would lean into, like, how do you grow old gracefully, you know, but stay sharp and stay vibrant and relevant and joyful. He just seemed to manage that stuff so well. And he had this interesting quality where, you know, when Keller was in the room, you knew he was smart. So you knew that he was like this top shelf intellectual, but he also seemed really regular. And that's important to me. There didn't seem to be a lot of putting on of airs, and gosh, that's just rare among smart people. You know,
to that point, one of the I only crossed paths with him a couple times personally, but one of the interactions, and he would have no reason, he wouldn't have remembered this. It was at breakfast at a Gospel Coalition conference, maybe in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. and you know, I always try to make it a point to grab a meal with my dad or my parents if they were both there, yeah. because it was, you know, those were opportunities. And my dad's like, well, why don't we get breakfast? And they have sort of a kind of a green room breakfast area for the speakers.
Yeah.
Just kind of a lounge area. So I go in there and, you know, D.A. Carson's at a table over in the corner mm-hmm. reading and eating his breakfast. And the Kellers are at the table right next to us. My parents introduce us. It's like a 30-second interaction, very pleasant. And I sit down. And while I'm sitting there with my parents, I realize that I'm hearing a voice that I'm really, really familiar with talking. And I yeah. realize that Tim Keller talking to Kathy Keller is exactly the same as Tim Keller preaching.
That's awesome.
And not because he preaches at his wife, but because he just has this very mellow, conversational tone. And oh, we got the contractor on. And so it, when he preaches, it doesn't sound like he's being pompous or like he's being yeah. the smartest guy yeah. in the room, but rather just conversing. And it's part of the reason why he, I think, could be so winsome to people who instinctively would have been opposed to his preaching or been in a place of hardship, because he's just so mellow and chill. And it's like talking to his wife when he's talking about the sovereignty of God and suffering or whatever. And it made me laugh in that moment, but it also kind of gives a clue to the effectiveness of his ministry, I think.
Yeah, I know. It's funny you say that too. And to kind of go off on that one point for a minute, Pipe, he was a guy that kind of made me realize, you know, years ago that, oh, public speakers do this, preachers do this, but you know, I call it preacher voice. So like, you know, not having that ability to just like preach the way we're talking to each other right now, but always having to put on a little bit more of that tone and that, you know, you have the authority and you're, you know, volume wise, you're coming up. And I always thought, well, what I love about Keller is that he doesn't do that, but I don't know that I hear many people who don't do that or who intentionally don't do that. I remember Zach Eswine is a guy that said, yeah, you know, I preached for years with preacher voice. And then one time, you know, after the Lord had, you know, I'd been through all this stuff in my life. And that was one of the big changes that he made, was that he said, I'm not going to do that. And so he said he's had to really work at intentionally not doing that, you know, and just being just conversational, being, you know, just having that sort of that tone that's more dialogue than it is, you know, lectury, which is just yeah. so hard to do, as you well know, because you just kind of go into a mode, you know,
yeah.
and I think like Keller did not go into a mode. And, you know, when you hear him preach, it's fascinating because the guy's stuttering all over the place. He's saying every other word. You know, he's not like a guy that you would say, hey, speak. This is public speaking 101. You wouldn't do that with him. And yet he's this great speaker, but yet he's still breaking all the rules in terms of what you might learn in a preaching class. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to get a little pastor nerdy for a second, which, you know, we're talking about Tim Keller, so I feel like Pastor Nerdy is on brand. His sermon preparation is different. So, you know, I'm sure I do the preacher voice thing, but that's because I have a full manuscript. And so I'm working from a fully formed document. He didn't do that. He had he would preach from one page with all sorts of notes and underlining and just sort of reminding him what he wanted to do with this stuff. And so his sermons were coming from inside his mind and his heart than off a page. Now, granted, that what's on the page comes out of mind and heart. So I'm not saying that the manuscript thing is bad, just a very different style of preparation.
Yeah.
And that's where he could just sort of, you know, like Bertrand Russell said this. And then he has this, you know, facility for quotation that's insane. But
yeah, he's collecting his thoughts while he's speaking, you know,
yeah, and, that, And not, yeah. So he's not crisply hitting every note, which is part of the reason why he could preach so conversationally, I think, because, he's not trying to give life to a document. He's trying to just share what is sort of pouring out of him in the same way you would across a table at breakfast, maybe.
Yeah. I love how you said that. He wasn't trying to give life to a document. That's so true. So he was, I always, cause I tend to, I don't have like a hard, I have sort of a semi-manuscript, it's kind of how I do it. But so I am gathering thoughts in the moment. I'm certainly no Tim Keller, but it's, when you do what he did the way he did it, it was like, hey, come into my head for 30 minutes and we're going to figure this thing out. I'm going to get everything across that I need to get across. But it's not going to be the most linear, and that's okay. Like you're kind of diving into my head with me here for 30 minutes. I like that. It was really different, especially given if you want to talk about our tribe, quote unquote, where everything is so mapped out and everything has to be so precise. And he was a guy where you always understood him with incredible clarity, but it was, I don't know that you could say it was, I mean, he would get to precision. He would get to clarity. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you would describe it as precise, right? Maybe that's not the right way to put it.
I like that you said 30 minutes a couple times. Like he's in the don't have to go long hall of fame for me. Like I love that his sermons were 30 minutes, and this in the era where every reform guy was going 50 minutes bare minimum, he didn't have to remake the same point 14 times. And I think that's I think it's a product of confidence, like the right kind of confidence where you don't feel like you have to say the same thing 14 times or make a 30 minute thing into a 55 minute thing.
Product of knowing his people, he knows that he has people in the room who are highly theologically attuned or trained, but a ton of his people are basically biblically illiterate. And so what he needs to hit is the high points of the storyline of the Bible or the high points of these key kind of theological realities from this text. Like if you watch how he preaches, like the book of Mark, which I think they turned into a book called, it was called The King's Cross. I think they might've changed the name of it, but it's more thematic where he just sort of hits, like, this is the point of Mark, not let's walk through it expositionally, which again is a very useful way to go through it, but not in his context. And so he created a, I don't know if he created, because he was kind of John Stott-esque in that way, but he popularized a way of preaching that really effectively counterbalanced the like what, what my dad does, which is spend 9 years on the book of Romans. Keller would have preached Romans in 2 months.
Well, it's so funny you say that because I don't know when I saw this. It was years ago, but I'll never forget it because I kind of do this a little bit. But there was like a panel exchange between your pops and TK, and your pops was kind of bemoaning new preachers who basically read the text and then jump off the text and just start riffing, telling stories. And they sort of loosely reference the text instead of being immersed in the text, right? Mm-hmm. And he's not wrong, right? I don't know. And so he's talking about all this stuff. And then it's so funny, it pivots over to Keller. And Keller kind of pauses and he goes, just kind of what I do, though. That's what people have accused me of my whole life, is I just sort of jump off the text and just start talking. And, I think there's a way to do that. So he wasn't, he wasn't defensive about it, but he looked at John and he just goes, yeah, but that's what I do too. So, here we
are.
That's
funny. Yeah. Well, and I think we can confidently say they're both right. And they were both great at what they did. And
different angles. Just coming at things from different angles. Yeah.
Like I'm truly grateful for both approaches and both guys.
And
but
both
they were
of them
very
have,
different.
And both of them have spawned really bad imitators. Like, what my dad would be bemoaning there is people who suck at doing what Tim Keller did excellently. Keller could jump off of a text and say a bunch of other things because in his mind he's weaving together whole commentaries and biblical theology and he's distilling it. Mm-hmm. And what other people are doing is losing the thread altogether. You know, whereas then there's guys who try to preach like my dad, and they spend 9 years in Romans, and they should have spent maybe 9 months, maybe 9 weeks. And they're really bad at kind of careful exposition. So both of them have bred some poor imitators.
Yeah, no question. Both. It's an interesting commentary on talent, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I just think those guys were like 99th percentile talents, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, the imitators, we can't do it because we don't have the horsepower, you know? And that's okay. We can just enjoy the talent for what it was.
And 99th percentile workers as well. Like one of the things, so I read that Colin Hanson book as well. And it wasn't what I expected. I expected a little bit more sort of traditional biography, and it was much more about kind of the influences that shaped Tim Keller. But one of the biggest takeaways I got out of it was, oh, that man both has an intellect that I will never match and the capacity for work that most people can't match. Yeah, you know, and just in terms of the breadth of reading, the depth of reading, the ability to absorb. And, you know, my dad is a very different kind of worker, but similar in terms of just nobody works harder than he does, at least in his, you know, in the peak of his ministry. You know, he's slowing down a little bit in his mid to late 70s. But those guys were so profoundly diligent.
Yeah.
Especially in that particular area. I mean, it's like, I think, you know, again, not to get too weedy or nerdy here, but it was like new preachers that spend way too long sermon prepping and eventually they spend less time. It's like those are two guys that never eventually spent less time. They just were. It's kind of what they did in some ways. Mm.
I'm pretty sure Keller could write a sermon in like 12 minutes because he had been writing that same sermon for 30 years. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, that's a good point, but you know what I mean? Like, these guys were still very studious.
Yes.
And I think they were studious in a way that both of those guys went into the pulpit knowing exactly what they were going to say in some ways, you know? And, you know, when you know, with the way some of us have come up in seminary and with manuscripts, you don't have to know the material as well, right? You got other things to do. You're spending more time. This is what I would say. They came from an era where like most important thing was, you know, what they were doing in the pulpit. We've probably come up in an era where it's like, well, that's part of it, but you got to consider these other things and devote time to these other things. And so it seems like they were way more focused on preaching is everything. I'm devoting my life to preaching. We devote our lives to other things as well as the preaching.
Yeah. And I think they may have been onto something.
They may have been on the something.
Yeah. Boys, we're definitely on to something. We should get on to being off the program. But that was 41 minutes of good radio. Fun to talk about Timmy K. It's just fun to like talk about somebody you like. We should do that more often, I suppose. But I enjoyed it. It was easy. It was fun. Appreciate you guys doing it. Appreciate you guys listening, listeners. You know what to do. 5-star us. Look forward with great anticipation to our live show, which we'll be dropping details about next week. Links to tickets, etc. It's going to be in September. Going to be in Indianapolis. Going to be in conjunction with some other conference. But it will be a great time because it always is. Boys, we've done what we always do on the program, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Hey friend, I'm Brooke McLaughlin, host of the Everyday Prayers podcast, a ministry of Million Praying Moms, and I'm here to invite you to partner with God for the hearts of your children on the daily. Our goal at Everyday Prayers is to help moms understand and pray God's word. Join us each weekday as we share insights from God's word for today's Christian mom. Tune in to the Everyday Prayers podcast in your favorite app or by visiting lifeaudio.com.